Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. About 71% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. The oceans hold about 96.5% of all Earth's water, but according to NOAA's Office of Ocean Exploration and Research, humans have only explored 5% of the planet's oceans. And what we are finding in the deep sea is incredible. There are thought to be a million species living in the dark, deep ocean. It is a vast repository of biodiversity. Animals move slowly, grow slowly, and reproduce slowly. Corals in the deep sea can live for over 4,000 years. Sponges have been alive for more than 10,000 years, and they don't deal well with change or disturbance. And that is a real possibility if deep sea mining is allowed to happen. We know the world needs to transition away from fossil fuels, but things like electric car batteries and solar panels will require huge amounts of minerals like cobalt, copper, nickel, and lithium. And those minerals can be found at the bottom of the ocean. The World Bank predicts that by 2050, global demand for minerals will increase by nearly 500%. Multinational mining companies are hoping to start mining the deep sea next year, but scientists and environmental justice advocates are warning about the harmful consequences for biodiversity and marine life. They argue that the deep sea, the last pristine area on Earth, should be left alone. Tests have already shown that areas that have been mined have not recovered. Last year, more than 600 scientists from around the world issued a call to pause deep sea mining. Scientists and activists are also calling on companies and governments to sign on. In February, the electric vehicle startup Rivian, which is backed by Amazon and Ford, said it would keep the deep sea out of their vehicles. Rivian joins BMW, Volvo, Volkswagen, Google, and others as pressure mounts to halt this emerging industry. In February, California legislators introduced a bill to ban seabed mining in state waters. There's also a lot of activity in Europe. Joining us to talk about this are two guests. Dr. Lisa Levin is professor of biological oceanography at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a board member of the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. Professor Levin is one of the signatories calling for a pause in deep sea mining. Hi, Professor Levin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Farah Obaidallah is founder and director of Women for Ocean. It's an organization that seeks to communicate the plight of our oceans through the lens of women working to protect it. Hi, Farah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. Farah, I want to start off with you. We did a show about the documentary you were featured in and your group was involved with called Into Deep a couple of months ago. And you're doing really important work on deep sea mining. You have a very interesting organization called Women for Ocean. Can you just first off tell us a bit about why you decided to start this organization and the work that you all do?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working in the ocean space, campaigning and advocating for ocean health for coming up to 20 years now. And in all that time, wherever I've been, whether it's been in sort of rural areas, coastal communities, or in the corridors of, you know, the United Nations, for example, or in governmental sort of halls of power, what I've observed is that there is this sort of skewed sort of demographic, and it's largely men that are deciding the fate of our ocean and our planet in general. And I wondered, as a sort of as a biologist, I wondered, well, what is it that we're doing that is so at odds with other animals, you know, on this planet? And, you know, it just occurred to me that what we're not doing, and we really need to think about, you know, sort of different ways of approaching the way we inhabit this planet, is we're not embracing our human diversity and not bringing diverse perspectives to the table when it comes to deciding how we manage the world's resources. And women are, you know, more than half of the population, and we are very much underrepresented in the ocean space, and indeed all spaces, really. So that was a sort of realization I had. So I set up Women for Oceans as a sort of platform to connect and amplify women in particular, but also really to promote diversity in the ocean space as a way to drive solutions, as a way to accelerate solutions. So that's the background.
And if you'd like to learn more about this group, you can find a link at Women for Ocean. Professor Levin, what about you? How long have you been doing this work, and how did you get involved?
Oh, gee, I would say my interest in seabed mining is maybe a decade old, but not much more than that. I have an interesting backstory to this. I basically had a sabbatical in Namibia, where I was working with the Fisheries Institute studying their deep offshore waters. And at that time, the Fisheries Ministry learned by surprise that their their continental margin seafloor had been leased out for phosphate mining. And these were prime fishing grounds, and they were totally taken by surprise. And I realized that Namibia had no deep sea scientists and practicing in the country, and they had no clue about what their seafloor life was that would be impacted by deep seabed mining. So I began to get interested in the confluence of humans in the deep sea and management questions. And this is partly how the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative came to be.
Well, can you begin by just telling us what we are learning about the deep sea? As I said, we did a show recently about this really incredible documentary called Into Deep. And we learned that the deep sea is the largest ecosystem on the planet. It provides the majority of habitable space on Earth, which is incredible to think about. And then these creatures that we're learning about are just absolutely amazing to watch.
Actually, what we're learning and have learned over the last half century or so is that the deep sea is not one ecosystem. It is a huge myriad of different ecosystems, each with its own biodiversity, its own way of functioning, and probably its own significance to humans and the planet. And so we have canyons and seamounts and abyssal plains. Seamounts are like underwater mountains. We have whole mountain ranges in the ocean with their own type of life. We have chemosynthetic ecosystems like methane seeps and hydrothermal vents. We have low oxygen areas. We have massive reefs made of sponges and corals in deep water. And so we're just beginning to learn about these. And in fact, we keep discovering new ecosystems down there. So we have to think about it the way we might think about land. Land isn't really one ecosystem, and the same is true for the ocean.
Farah, what would you add about what we're learning about the deep ocean?
Well, I mean, just as Lisa said, I mean, we can't consider the ocean as one ecosystem. And in fact, you know, as you said at the beginning of the show, the ocean makes up over 70% of our planet's surface area. So it's not surprising that there's going to be so much diversity and variety in the oceans. And so we need to be treating it as such. And before we make any, rushed decisions that will have such severe impacts to life in the deep ocean, we need to understand what we're dealing with, what the consequences are for causing such irreversible damage. I think Lisa just mentioned it as well, but there are so many species that living down in the deep ocean, we haven't yet discovered even a fraction of what might be down there. So it's crazy to think that we might be destroying what's living down there before we've even discovered it.
Well, let's talk about what is actually happening right now, the issue at hand. We've done so many shows about the need to transition away from fossil fuels, but that means that demand for things like solar panels and electric vehicle batteries are just going to increase. I mentioned the World Bank numbers. And then you've got the International Energy Agency saying demand for these materials could soar 600% over the next two decades. So Farah, can you just lay this out for us? You know, why we're even talking about this issue right now?
Right. Well, I mean, if you think about the projections that are being made, they're being made based on status quo technology. And if you look at sort of the companies that are developing the transition or the electrical vehicles, they're already saying that we don't necessarily need those metals from the deep ocean. And so, you know, we should be thinking about what the future of battery technology looks like, and not what battery technology looks like today. So I'm quite confident through all the literature that I read and the companies that I speak to, I'm quite confident that if we really take an honest look at what we need, what it already exists in the supply chains, and what we can still source if we do it sustainably from land-based sources, I'm quite confident that we don't need to be mining the deep ocean for metals. Remember that we use so many metals in our everyday gadgets, and most of that ends up on piles of waste that's either incinerated or dumped in places where, unfortunately, you know, children and others are trying to recover metals from those waste streams. But the reality is there is so much metal in our waste streams that we could do a better job at recovering this urban mining. We could also think about how we can reduce our metals in our supply chains and use less. But importantly, and I think that's where, you know, that's what your question is about, we are seeing a change in the battery technology emerging. And there's already demonstrated success from companies like Tesla or BYD, which is the second largest producer of electric vehicles in the world. It's a Chinese company. They are already demonstrating that they don't need these metals from the deep ocean for their batteries. And there are other companies, Volkswagen, but also technology companies like IBM, that are showing success of developing technology without these metals from the deep ocean. So coming back to your point about the projections that are made, I think, that's based on if we continue to use the technology we do today.
Right. And we'll talk about the companies in a little bit, because we did find a few statements, and I'd love to get your reaction about how this would actually play out. Dr. Levin, what would you add on this? I mean, the one thing that was very interesting about the documentary is to learn about the key material in batteries. They're potato-sized nodules, and they pepper the sea floor. They're particularly abundant in the Clarion-Clipperton zone in the North Pacific Ocean, which is an area spanning millions of kilometers between Hawaii and Mexico. So what are your thoughts about the demand, the increased demand for these materials?
Well, I think Farah covered most of the important points about changing battery technologies, our developing ability to reuse and recycle the metals in the batteries that we and cell phones and other electronics that we have. I think that there are actually sources on land that are untapped. And so the real question is whether we do have to go into the deep ocean. Not all of the reserves are actually being used right now. I always get the technical language of reserves mixed up, but basically, land mining has a much, much smaller footprint than deep seabed mining, and it continues to improve both in terms of environmental impacts and in terms of social impacts. So I think that, again, all the arguments are based on status quo, but over time, there are changes in how we do land-based minerals extraction that are bode well. The other question is whether we actually need a billion new electric cars, or whether there will be changes in transportation approaches, you know, ride sharing and mass transport and other things like that. Now, let me go back. Did you want me to say something specific about the Clarion-Clipperton Zone?
Yes, please.
I think that we are making new discoveries about that region all the time. There are something like 19 or 20 exploration contracts in the area. It's important to recognize that it's nation states that hold these contracts and they work with mining companies. But in international waters, the companies themselves cannot have direct access to the seabed. So these potato-sized nodules that you talk about form over millions of years. They form very, very slowly, and we're discovering that they provide really important substrate, or that's a dwelling habitat for specific animals. And once you remove those nodules, there will be biodiversity loss, because about half of the species that occur in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone rely on attachment to those nodules. And we really don't know much about those organisms, what it would mean to lose them, what exactly their functions are. And in fact, most of the species still remain undescribed, but every time there are new studies conducted out there, they're called baseline studies, because they establish what is there sort of at the start of an era. And we keep discovering new species and new functions for some of these species.
Please go ahead. I was just going to say, it's incredible to think that it takes these nodules about millions of years to develop.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's another reason to be super cautious about moving forward, with it, not just removing these nodules, but actually sucking them up and with all the associated damage and plumes that will cause. But I just also want to sort of highlight, bring to the fore for your audience, that we're dealing with two crises at the moment. One is the climate crisis, which we are all too aware about. And the other is the loss of biodiversity, which world leaders have said they will pledge to, put a halt to. So going into the deep ocean, it does two things. One, it will definitely cause irreversible harm to life in the deep ocean. We know that because exactly for the reasons that you said, life is slow growing down there. And it will take too long to recover, certainly on human time scales. And also because we don't know yet what's down there. So we're losing biodiversity before we've even discovered it. But the second thing is, and that's something that we just simply don't understand yet, is what the consequences are to disturbing carbon that's locked away in the deep seabed. We know that the technology that they want to introduce to mine the deep sea will cause disturbance to the seafloor sediment up to 30 centimeters or so. And it's in the top sort of, we don't even know exactly how far down, but it's in the top layers of the seabed that a lot of carbon is stored. And if we start disturbing that, that will, be reintroduced back into the ocean. And we don't know what consequences that might have. You might say, well, it's so deep in the ocean that carbon won't reach the surface anytime soon. But we still don't know what consequence it will have to the biological pump or the carbon cycle in the ocean. For example, will it contribute to ocean acidification, which we know is a big problem that the ocean is facing and will pose a problem to our food systems as well. So there's, I just want to remind everybody that this is a twin crisis that we're dealing with. And what the pro-mining industry is now suggesting is that we introduce another reckless industry that takes us back into the last century in terms of not being circular, in terms of just taking, making and wasting in a very linear fashion as we've done in previous industries, rather than embracing the new model of business that we want to adopt, which is about being sustainable, being circular, being renewable, and so on.
To give listeners a visual of how this would actually happen, it could take several hours for a collector vehicle to actually reach the deep sea floor. And then just picture like a vacuum cleaner that is driving around and just kind of creating chaos everywhere. It would basically create an underwater sandstorm, and the animals could be crushed and killed. the underwater sediment would be released back into the ocean. Farah, can you just give us a visual of what this actually looks like and what would happen?
Sure. So the way it's being presented is that indeed there'll be these big collector vehicles, see them as sort of bulldozers that will be lowered down onto the seafloor. These bulldozers will then proceed to sort of, yeah, disturb the ocean floor in the process of sucking up the nodules. These nodules will then be lifted through suction pipes to the vessel on the surface of the water. And in that process, well, once it reaches the surface, it will be cleaned and processed on board the vessel. And then the wastewater from that cleaning process will be released back into the ocean, causing yet another wave of sediment plumes. So you've got the sediment plumes, as you described, Rose, happening at the bottom, sort of in where the suction is happening. And that will be transported for potentially hundreds of kilometers from the mining area by the currents. And because life is so slow growing there and also slow moving, you know, this could take a very long time for the sediment to move and settle back down. But in that process, it could suffocate life in the water column, but also on the seafloor again. So it's this huge sandstorm, as you described it, that could really cover hundreds of kilometers extending beyond the mining area. And then the secondary plume or secondary waste water that will be released from the vessel could cause another wave of disruption and suffocation for life in the midwater column and higher. And also there's impacts that we know will happen, but we obviously haven't understood yet, but because it isn't operational yet, but we know that noise will be a big factor in noise pollution will be a big factor in deep sea mining. So again, these are bulldozers. They're going to make a lot of noise. For those nodules to be sucked up is going to cause going to require a lot of power, which will cause a lot of noise pollution affecting migratory species, whales, and so on. So there's a lot of things we know will happen. We know will impact life in the deep ocean. And then there's a lot of things that we don't yet know or fully understand, but which we certainly should understand before we proceed with before we allow such an industry to go ahead.
Before we go to break, Professor Levin, can you tell us about the International Seabed Authority, the UN body that oversees mining in international waters?
Yes, this is an entity that was created by the UN Convention on Law of the Sea, which is basically like the constitution for the international ocean. And it created a body that has membership comprised of all the states that signed and ratified the Law of the Sea. And they have jurisdiction over the mineral resources in the international seafloor, but they also have the mandate to protect the marine environment. And the ISA is complex. It has a legal and technical commission that makes recommendations and a council and an assembly comprised of different nation states. And they vote approving at this point exploration contracts, but the International Seabed Authority at this time is now generating regulations for commercial exploitation. So that's on the docket. There was a new 2-year rule triggered that is sort of rushing things. And so environmental management now is going full steam ahead, environmental planning, with some states, I believe, hoping to begin mining within the next year or two.
Farah, what else would you add? The Seabed Authority is getting more media attention. The LA Times recently reported that the budget is pretty small at $10 million. Auditors and key ISA staff have raised concerns over the authority's financial controls. And then on April 1st, The Guardian reported that the ISA has been accused of failings of transparency after an independent body responsible for reporting on negotiations was kicked out. That is the Earth Negotiations Bulletin. So can you just bring us up to date on this? These were pretty in-depth reports.
Right. Well, it goes to show that there is a lack of confidence and faith in the International Seabed Authority. It has really brought into question, is the ISA fit for purpose? Is the International Seabed Authority actually fit to manage a new and potentially enormous industry? I mean, without going into the details of the reports, but what has been sort of surfacing over the last couple of years is the conflict of interest that the ISA has in terms of, on the one hand, issuing licenses for exploration, and on the other hand, as Lisa also said, they have this mandate to protect life in the deep ocean. And if you look at the dealings of, in particular, the sort of the Secretary General of the ISA, and as these journalists have unveiled, there is this conflict of interest because the Secretary General is quite clearly siding on the industry that's, or the companies that are really pushing for deep sea mining to happen sooner rather than later. And he's clearly not taking the precautionary approach and listening to the scientists that are saying, hey, we first need to understand what the consequences are of seabed mining before we go ahead with this industry. Because remember, once we start seabed mining, it'll be very difficult to stop. And this is an international, it's the international commons, international waters, and there's so many nations here that are deciding at the International Seabed Authority. And if you allow one country to start mining, then of course it opens the floodgates to allow all the other countries to come in and mine as well. I think there are 31 or so exploration licenses that have been issued to date. And just to give you some context, I think each one of those licenses is 8 to 10,000 square kilometers. I forget the exact number, but it's huge areas that potentially will be mined if we allow this to allow this to happen. And also, if these licenses are for a 30-year period, I believe. So I can't stress the importance of caution enough before allowing such a mammoth industry to sort of take hold in the deep ocean without any scrutiny or oversight from anyone, because who's going to go down into the deep ocean to audit?
Well, exactly. I was just going to ask you, how in the heck is this going to be regulated? But I'll ask you more about that after a break. Farah Obaidallah is a biologist and founder and director of Women for Ocean, an organization that seeks to communicate the plight of our oceans through the lens of women working to protect it. Dr. Lisa Levin is professor of biological oceanography at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and board member of the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. Professor Levin is one of the signatories calling for a pause in deep sea mining. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our discussion on abortion rights in the U.S. We'll talk about how we got here, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, libertarians like the Koch brothers working with the religious right and dark money. We're going to do three shows. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how we got here. Wednesday, we'll check in with clinics across the country. And then Thursday, how far is this going to go? We're already hearing about calls to ban birth control. So we're going to talk about that for the next 3 days. Today, we are talking about what it will take to stop deep sea mining. Multinational mining companies are hoping to start mining the deep sea next year, but scientists and environmental justice advocates are warning about the harmful consequences to biodiversity and marine life. They say that the deep sea, the last pristine area on Earth, should be left alone. If you have any questions or comments for our guests about deep sea mining, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Today, we're joined by Farah Obaidallah, a biologist and founder and director of Women for Ocean. Dr. Lisa Levin is professor of biology oceanography at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a board member of the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. So before the break, we were just talking about how all of this would work. We are learning about the International Seabed Authority. And Dr. Levin, how would any of this be regulated?
Sorry, could I just interrupt one moment?
Because, oh, sure, please.
In the break, Lisa made an important point, and that is because I said before the break that I mentioned some numbers about the area that would be mined. Mm-hmm. And I just want to reiterate that it would vary greatly between the mining operations, because there's different types of mining that that are proposed. But perhaps Lisa wants to say more about that.
Oh, simply that the exploration contracts, and presumably the exploration contracts, would be 15-year contracts, although mining would go on significantly longer. And the sizes are highly variable depending on which resource, but in the Clarion-Clipperton zone where the polymetallic nodules occur, I believe the contract areas are 75,000 square kilometers, so very, very large, although not necessarily all of that space would be mined. Okay, so Rose, I think your question how would all this be regulated? Right. And it's an excellent question. I mean, there are, as I mentioned, the Convention on the Law of the Sea sets up some of the obligations of the International Seabed Authority, but they are still figuring out exactly the financial rules, who gets the money from the minerals, and how much of it goes to the ISA, how much of it goes to the people of the planet, because these resources are considered the common heritage of mankind, you know, how much, what kinds of taxes the contractors have to pay. But then there are bigger issues about environmental regulations, how to define serious harm, and the potential to stop mining should some serious harm be discovered. There are questions about compliance and monitoring, and how that would happen, and who's in charge of enforcing all of the regulations. There are questions about what happens at the end of a mining period in terms of any kind of rehabilitation of the area, how long the companies have to mine. And all of this is being discussed at different rates and in increasing intensity, but I would say none of it is completely worked out yet. And that's a little bit frightening if we, at least for the interests that want to begin mining very soon.
Lisa, you did an interview with Manga Bay, and you said that the U.S. National Science Foundation, the European Union, and the National Science Foundation of China have emerged as top public funders of deep sea research, but billionaires, foundations, and biotech companies are getting in on the act too. So can you just tell us more about who's getting involved in this, and what are the different interests here?
I'm not even sure I remember doing that interview, but I believe you. You said those are the things I said. I mean, there's definitely more and more people getting interested. A lot of the science has been funded by the contractors themselves as part of baseline work, and they employ academic deep sea scientists and scientists working for consulting companies. I mean, there's a whole slew of people being involved, but there is now interest in studying these areas independent of the mining contracts. And I know the EU has a whole variety of funders contributing to a program called JPI Oceans that goes and they've been working alongside the contractors. So when the contractors are testing a collector, they'll be there collecting independent science data. I do think the National Science Foundation has funded some work on this. I know that the NOAA Office of Ocean Exploration has sent ships out into the regions being considered for mining, and also other types of environments like seamounts, where people are looking to mine ferromanganese crust. There's a lot of new research being conducted there. But it is important to realize that studies in the deep sea are extremely expensive. The collection of samples is expensive, and it's technologically difficult. And so not only does the ship time cost a lot of money, but so do the remotely operated vehicles and other underwater instruments that are used by the scientists. So we are actually fairly limited in terms of the number of countries and the number of scientists that are capable of doing this work.
Farah, anything to add on the different interests that are getting involved in all of this besides the mining companies?
Well, from my perspective, what I'm seeing is a lot of interest coming from, civil society groups, from businesses, from scientists, from philanthropists. Essentially, the interest being we need to stop this industry from going ahead, or at least put in place a moratorium until we understand what's at stake. And that gives me hope as well, because it shows that there is no social license to mine the deep sea, not at this point, not until we can demonstrate that it really can be done sustainably, which with the current technology just simply doesn't seem to be the case. But really, so many civil society groups, not just environmental NGOs, but youth groups, women's groups, parliamentarians, parliament groups in the Pacific, in the EU, in the UK, they're all coming out and saying, no, we can't go ahead with this. So that's very hopeful. And then as well, businesses, many businesses that could potentially include deep sea minerals in their supply chains are now clearly saying, no, we won't do that. You mentioned Rivian at the start of the show. That's one company, but there are dozens of others that have either come out very clearly supporting a moratorium on deep sea mining and pledging not to source these minerals in their supply chains, or other companies that are very clearly distancing themselves from deep sea mining and saying, and having a statement to that effect in their procurement policies. So that engagement is also happening. And so we're seeing a huge interest in this issue over the past couple of years. And exactly because there is now this rush by a handful of companies to open up the seabed to seabed mining. And we could see it happening in as little as just over a year's time. If the ISA, the country that has triggered this 2-year rule that Lisa was referring to before the break, if they want to go ahead and mine, then essentially they can do that in as little as just over a year's time from now. So we have a short window with which to make our message heard loud and clear by the International Seabed Authority and by the international community, that there is no social license to mine the deep sea.
So let's talk just a little bit more about Nauru. This is a small island nation in the southwestern Pacific Ocean. Nauru sent a letter to the ISA last summer saying that it's going to begin mining the seafloor in international waters. And that's what triggered this 2-year rule. Is that right, Farah?
Yeah, so they essentially, there is this rule in the in the International Convention on the Law of the Sea that allows a country to trigger a so-called 2-year rule, which essentially means that they have the International Seabed Authority has 2 years to get put in place regulations and whatnot before which Nauru, in this case, can start mining. So whatever the status is of the regulations in 2 years' time, a year from now, because we're already a year forward, whatever the status is, Nauru can start mining. So even if there are no regulations in place, or even if the regulations are quite weak or poor and do not adequately address the concerns that scientists have, Nauru can essentially start mining as soon as July 2023, I believe. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a clip about mining in Nauru. And this is from the documentary In Too Deep about seabed mining. And in this clip, you will hear from Maureen Penjali, who is a coordinator with the Pacific Network on Globalization. That's a Fiji-based watchdog promoting Pacific people's right to be self-determining.
I think Nauru is a victim of both history and desperation. This is a country that sees deep sea mining as its only alternative livelihood. Their vulnerability makes them quite open to being taken advantage by contractors and multinational corporations such as the Metals Company. For Pacific people, we see ourselves as ocean people. So the ocean is quite central to our worldview, and it informs who we are on the international stage. Deep sea mining is a very critical issue for Pacific Islanders today. I think what most people tend to forget is that the Clarendon-Clipperton zone is still considered within the Pacific. And so when you think about how impacts will be felt, it will be felt by those countries that are closest to the Clarendon-Clipperton zone, including, you know, indigenous peoples in Hawaii, Kiribati, and certainly Cook Islands and Tahiti. So I think there's high risk for our island states, particularly the small island states, now and into the future.
Maureen Pengilly is a coordinator with the Pacific Network on Globalization, and that was a clip from the short documentary about deep sea mining, In Too Deep. Farah, what are you hearing from people living in places like Hawaii or Fiji about this issue?
It's actually quite consistent, and that is that there is real concern about the impacts that deep sea mining will have on the people of the Pacific, on their livelihoods, on their well-being. As Maureen says, you know, a lot of their well-being, and for many people around the world, a healthy ocean provides us with livelihoods, with you know, the oxygen that we breathe, with well-being, and jobs and income and so on. So this is all very much at stake if we start to open the seabed to mining, because as I said, you know, and as Lisa's been saying, we simply don't understand all the consequences, but we do know that they will be negative, they could impact. There's a study that came out, I think, just a year ago or just over a year ago, by some fisheries scientists that were trying to quantify, or at least qualify, what some of the consequences of seabed mining would be on fisheries, on fish catch in the Pacific Ocean. So they were looking in particular at tuna, and they could see, of course, deep sea mining doesn't happen yet. So this was a hypothetical review, but looking at modeling data of plumes and so on, and the impacts that are expected from deep sea mining. But what they saw, or what they concluded, was that deep sea mining will impact the tuna catches in the areas in and around where mining is proposed. That's already a very clear, tangible impact that seabed mining will have on fishers and fishing communities, and including the industrial fishing fleet. So that's why we're also seeing increasingly that fishing industry associations, not just local fishermen, but actual international industrial fishing associations, are speaking out against deep sea mining as well. We have the International Pole and Line Foundation, but also the European advisory councils that operate globally with their industrial fleet, that are also speaking out against deep sea mining. So this is a consistent message. Again, as I said, there's no social license, especially not from people that are going to be impacted the first and the most by deep sea mining, whether that's in Hawaii or in other small island Pacific states of the Pacific Ocean.
Lisa, do you know, where does China stand on this? The South China Morning Post had a piece in February called "Could the World's Deep Seas Become China's Mining Frontier?" Chinese researchers have spent the last decade mapping the globe's ocean floors looking for potential mineral deposits.
Yeah, I am not that familiar with China's stand, but they definitely hold a number of international exploration contracts that presumably would be converted to commercial exploitation contracts. And these contracts are not just for polymetallic nodules, they're for some seamounts, I believe. And I'm not sure whether they have any contracts for massive sulfides at hydrothermal vents. But I do know a number of Chinese scientists. They've definitely been ramping up their deep sea expertise and training programs over the past 10 to 20 years, so that they now have big ships and they have ROVs, and they're definitely capable of doing deep sea research. I've also seen some verbiage, or at least some ideas coming out, that there is a growing movement for protecting the deep sea among Chinese people as well. So I imagine that they're pretty much on parallel to what's happening over here in the United States and Europe. Mm.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. You know, I don't know enough about solar panels or electric vehicles and the relationship between those and the mining. I'm not exactly sure whether or not all this mining is going to be going towards trying to provide more electric vehicles, et cetera. But I want to make a suggestion. I mean, it seems to me that this is just another step trying to keep the current system in place, or at least prolong it. And I'm wondering if they have a suggestion in order to avoid the mining. Let's say every city in the United States with a population of over 500,000 had to basically electrify their entire transportation system, everything. You couldn't drive a carbon-based car in the city. You had to provide public transportation. If that were possible, and I think that's maybe pie in the sky, but if that were possible, would that be a way of trying to avoid, or being a way of avoiding trying to mine and do other things that would be more detrimental to the environment, whether it's in the ocean or on land?
Well, thank you for the question, Greg. Farah, do you want to take that first?
Sure. I mean, look, I personally don't think it's pie in the sky. I live in Europe, in the Netherlands, and of course our transport system and mode of transit is entirely different to the US. So I know in the US having a car is more mainstream and more essential for certain people. But I think in busy or in densely populated cities, I think it's certainly possible to have some kind of scheme whereby you limit the number of cars coming into the city center. We see that in many European cities already. So I think that's possible to be adopted in the US, and that you provide, good, clean transit, efficient transit for within cities. Of course, there's no going about, at least right now, there's very little alternative to cars when you're talking about rural places or, outside the city centers. But I do think that's possible. That will decrease our demand on minerals and metals. But I also think, as I said earlier in the program, this shift in battery technology will also eliminate the need for these metals. But I agree, we need to reduce the number of cars on the road anyway. One of the arguments from the mining industry, proponents for mining, is that we need to replace all 1.7 billion cars that are on the road today with electric vehicles. So that's simply not true, because we've also agreed as the international community that we need to be consuming less, and we need to rethink the way that our cities are built and the way we transport goods and ourselves. So I think it's a combination of things that we can do to limit the need for metals. But it's a good suggestion, and I would say bring it to your to your elected officials as a suggestion, particularly for city centers and for busy urban areas.
Mm. Well, thank you for the question, Greg. We have another one from Philip, who says, are all governments obliged to comply with the decisions of the regulators? There are so many countries with advanced technological capabilities, but admit to no authority but their own. Lisa, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, each country, if we're talking about deep seabed mining, each country owns its own waters and regulates its own waters out to 200 miles from shore. And so, and we haven't really discussed that, but there are some countries that are considered deep, carrying out mining within their own waters. In international waters, the countries that have signed and ratified the law of the sea are the ones making the decisions there. But in terms of what happens on land, we have to acknowledge there's a strong link between what happens on land and what happens in the ocean. And, going back to the previous question, we're looking at a problem within a problem, right? Because we're trying to combat climate change and reduce emissions. And we know that electrification is an important pathway. But of course, that electricity has to come from renewable energy. That's an important thing to remember. And many of the renewable energy technologies, solar panels and wind turbines, for example, and as well as the electric car batteries, are what's driving the interest in deep seabed minerals and driving the increased demand for cobalt, nickel, copper, and so on. We definitely have a challenge ahead of us.
Mm. Well, what can people do to get involved, given the time frame here? What's most effective at this point, Lisa?
Well, you know, in terms of people involved, I think that the most important thing you can probably do is vote and vote in the types of people that have the same opinions you do about what should be happening on this planet. That's a really important vehicle. And then basically, I would say, inform yourself. There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of papers, published papers about deep seabed mining, and many, many articles. There are certainly bills that are up in California, for example. You can write to your legislators if you care about mining within California waters. And I know Oregon and Washington have already put on a ban for mining in their territorial waters, so you can interact. But then, of course, we all, in terms of choices we make with our lives, you can get involved by just making choices about what you drive and what you eat and what you recycle and how you get from place to place and so on.
Farah, what would you add? We have about a minute left.
Right. No, I would echo very strongly what Lisa says. Use your voting power. That's super important. But very concretely on deep sea mining, if you're a CEO or if you're in a business or own a business out there, then consider signing on to the business statement at noseabedmining.org and join companies such as Google, Samsung, a number of others that have said no to seabed mining. If you're an individual, then sign on to the our pre-divest campaign at defendthedeep.org, which is where, you know, you can raise your hand and say no to seabed mining. And as Lisa said, keep yourself informed and use your voting power. And I would also urge you to watch In Too Deep, The Hidden Cost of Seabed Mining, so you can get a thorough sort of understanding of what's at stake. Those would be my suggestions.
Yes, well, thank you for that. And it's just about a 20-minute film, In Too Deep. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org and be sure to share it with everyone, really everyone you know, because this does affect all of us. Farah Obaidullah is a biologist and founder and director of Women for Ocean, an organization that communicates the plight of our oceans through the lens of women working to protect it. Farah, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Lisa Levin is professor of biological oceanography at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a board member of the Deep Ocean Steward Initiative. Professor Levin, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.